The following Dharma talk was recorded in May 2015 in St. Louis, Missouri, from the retreat called Anatta, the Buddha's Teaching on Non-Self, taught by Gloria Tarania Ambrosia. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Gloria Tarania Ambrosia teaches within the Thai Forest tradition and is a lay Buddhist minister in association with Abhayagiri Buddhist Monastery in California. She has been a Dhamma teacher since 1990, served as a resident teacher of the Insight Meditation Society from 1996 to 1999, and is a core faculty member at Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, where she does most of her teaching. For more information, go to www.bcbsdharma.org.
So what I have in front of me is the Satipatthana Sutta, which many of you are familiar with. But if you're not, this is the premier teaching on the meditation practice that the Buddha offers, the four foundations of mindfulness. And it's worthy of note how many of the teachings are so integrated. They're all, in essence, coming at the same issues, and but doing it from different angles. And so, what I put out this last night about the five aggregates: body, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, is one way of seeing the activities of the mind and learning how to relate to it skillfully. But it's very much also reiterated in this Foundations of Mindfulness. And so you'll see the parallels. Well, what the Buddha is saying in this teaching, and just an overview, is to become attuned to what is happening in the body, starting with the breath, looking at the various postures that the body is in, looking at your activities throughout the day, and try to train the mind. Bhavana, meditation is mental development. Develop the mind, train the mind, cultivate the mind in the actual experience of just knowing what's happening. That's very much what I was saying last night. Just know that this is what the body, how the body is disposed at this moment. This is what it is doing. It's breathing. It's standing. It's walking. It's sitting. It's lying down. It's eating. It's changing clothes. All of this. Yeah. So, and this is all, spelled out in the first foundation of mindfulness. And my long and short of it is see the body as the body and leave it at that. And that's a tall order because of this habit that I was alluding to last night of having something to say about it, wanting to do something with it, resisting it, getting lost in it, indulging it. That habit is so strong in the unawakened mind that it can be difficult to overcome. So, you know, if you understand meditation like this, then this can be very, very helpful. What we're trying to do through mindfulness of the body is just let the body be. Let it be what it is. Stop taking everything so personally, indulging it, resisting it, not seeing what's happening, right? So that, and then he goes on from there and says to do the same thing at the feeling level, the feeling tone, the experience of pleasure, pain, and neither. You know, when feeling a pleasant feeling, one knows, I feel a pleasant feeling. That's so simple. You know, the language is so simple as to really escape the profundity of what's being said here. You know, when have you ever had a pleasant feeling and just, oh, this is pleasant, you know? I mean, we do. But it's not a common experience until we meditate, you know? Oh, this is so nice. And the mind not grabbing it or wanting to do it again next week, you know, or get it again or whatever. You know, that reactive pattern that I was talking to about last night, that's a dominant feature of a mind that doesn't see what's happening, right? You know, it goes on when feeling a painful feeling, one understands, I feel a painful feeling. You know, and it's, I mean, I don't know about you, but my early retreats, and certainly occasionally now, you know, you have a distressful feeling in the body, for example, or in the mind. And it's like, I'm dying, you know, this is awful. That feeling like you might have maybe when you're sitting and maybe you have a pain, and you know that if you just could shift your posture dramatically, that would be gone. And yet you've made a determination not to do that. You know, I'm not suggesting that you have to practice like that, but sometimes it's very skillful. And so watch the mind just go crazy around, painful, pleasant and painful feeling. It wants the one, it wants to get away from the other, and it just kind of checks out around a lot of the ordinariness of life when things, there's not a whole lot happening. So can you see the parallels here, like with what I was saying last night? And then the third foundation of mindfulness, which, you know, I find this to be incredibly mature practice. It can take a while for us to be able to do the same thing with mental events, so that the whatever state comes up into the mind, that you know it, and you leave it there, leave it at that, without breathing it back into life, getting lost in it. So, and he goes through a whole litany here, and he says, you know, that one understands that right now the mind is affected by lust, or it's not affected by lust. It's affected by hatred, or it's not affected by hatred. It's affected by delusion, sloth. He goes through some of the hindrances. He goes through various exalted states of mind that one can get into as a meditator. But the undercurrent of it all, to me, just the brilliance of it. He's even mental events, which we are enormously identified with. You know, we think, therefore we are. We think they're who we are, you know. He's actually saying just to know that the mind is affected by that. That's a radically different relationship with it than it's me and I have to become it. You know, so that to know, for example, when you take a jab, and you take a gazillion jabs a day, don't you? I mean, some of them are minor little transgressions where somebody says something untoward, you know, or, you know, whatever, or maybe it's more coarse levels of it. But to know that that just happened, and to stay there with it instead of going on about what you're going to do about it, or building your case. I mean, that one is huge in the mind. And, you know, just watching it, in my own meditation, really, noticing how, so many times throughout the course of a day, a minor or not so minor, transgression, if you will, or jab comes at me. And the mind is going into all kinds of reactivity to that in a way that sort of is designed to defend me against it, but doesn't do that. It just creates a whole nother layer of delusion and anxiety and antagonism. You know, it does. This is what the unawakened mind does. It throws up states in reaction to what's happening that don't do anything about it but make it worse, you know. And I'll talk more about this tonight. But we've got to be able to see it, see these things, and in a way train the mind to stay in its posture of relaxed awareness. Just to be aware and to know it as such is brilliant. And you, as I said, you have to be willing to commit to that for a long period of time, to just responding in that way, because the habit of getting tangled is so great. It's almost like you got to be as persistent in the opposite direction as that is in this direction to be able to gradually untangle it and offset the habit of the mind to go bonkers about everything. And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha walks through how to relate to the hindrances, how to relate to the aggregates, how to relate to sensory experience, how to relate to skillful states, you know, and to see the noble truths. So it's, you know, I think we're the beneficiaries of a great technology, if you will, but also, it's more than a technology. It's an actual prescription or description of, awakening. You know, a mind that is awake knows the body is breathing and lets it breathe. A mind that is awake knows that there's pleasant, unpleasant, and neither feeling, and doesn't necessarily get lost in that. A mind that is awake knows that a state has come into it. And the Ajahn Chah would call the states visitors. Something has occurred. Something has come into the mind. And if I can know that my mind is reacting with hatred to something that I find difficult, I've got tremendous options suddenly opened up to me. If I don't know that, I'm at the mercy of it. The only thing I know is to hate it and to go along with these deluded, ridiculous responses to things that don't serve us and don't help us. So there's a lot to meditation, isn't there? and a lot to what the Buddha is laying out for us. And I really like to talk about the dynamics of it all a lot, because that really has helped me so much in my own practice. Is that if I understand what I'm doing and what the foundations of mindfulness is designed to do, how these teachings are also integrated in getting at the same thing, you know, then it's hugely helpful. You know, you could bring in any one of the teachings and relate it to just these two that I just talked about last night and this morning, you know. And it's all very, very, very integrated and all very much saying the same thing. So let me put it out to you and see if you have some thoughts or questions. And how's it going? How are you doing with this? Don't be shy.
So earlier in my practice, I guess when I was sort of in the beginning, and I think it might be effort related, things got very still very quickly, and it lasted for a good long while, often.
Mm-hmm.
And more lately, for at least a year, it hasn't been really spread out thinking about this, that, or the other. It's more longer periods of maybe one or two basic kinds of thoughts, and then I come back and it's quiet for a bit, and then. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that. I'm thinking maybe it's effort related.
How do you mean effort related? That the effort is good, or that you need some tweaking of the effort?
Maybe tweaking, like that I was putting in to.
No, I think it's tricky. If I'm hearing you, it's like it was easier, and now it's a little more complicated, you know. You know, if that's what you're saying, yeah. This is a good question, because it really points to the same kinds of things I've been talking about, that the mind will think it knows what's going on and react to it, and you can get lost in the reaction to it, when actually I think what you're describing can very well be, and probably is, progress in practice. You know, because for a long time, it's kind of beginner's luck. You know, you can really settle in. You know, somebody says do it, and you go, oh, okay. And you do it, you know, and it can go on for a long time. And you can ride the wave of that, and it's great practice and it's great stuff. And if you're also looking, not just enjoying the calm, you know, which is fine to enjoy the calm, but also using the calm to look and see what's going on, then you're going to start to see things. And what that means, how that plays out, is it can feel like you lost it. Because now, but in reality, you're actually seeing more. Can you feel that? Yeah, you're actually seeing more of what the mind is doing. And therefore, you're getting to subtler and subtler levels of clinging and grabbing, you know? And so that's good. I'd say A plus. Okay? And so the effort, like I was saying, I think last night or this morning, the effort, the striving in practice is not so much a making something happen as it is trying to offset the habitual reaction. So the habitual reaction in something like that might be, I'm screwing up, you know, I had it and I lost it, you know. You know, maybe yes, maybe no. just stay open. Yeah. What else?
I notice quite often I'll have a never-ending tune going on. And I'm not going to name it. and I think I'm working with it skillfully.
Yeah.
In that, I just recognize, well, there it is. And then I recognize that I don't want it to be there, and I want it to be quiet. And then going back to just let it be there, but then I do turn my attention either back to the breath or body and walking and try to just let it, not try to let it, but, you know, let it be okay to be there, but it's in the background.
Yeah.
And then just notice how the aversion to it comes up and then, okay, well, so that's there. Mm-hmm. But the redirecting my attention, I'm seeing that as a skillful way to be with it and recognizing that there is some aversion. Is there any benefit to making it the object?
Yeah, definitely. Did everybody hear the question? Yeah, and this is a good one, you know. I mean, I had a Bruno Mars tune running the whole last retreat, you know, and it was some line from the song was something that I was seeing, you know, and I just kept repeating it. But it's really great stuff to practice with because I think, you know, you're right on. You see the aversion to it. I don't want that to be there. And we want to be able to sort of be sensitized to the fact that whether you indulge it or hate it, you're feeding it. So that aversion to it is actually keeping it around. Right? But more than that, because you could say, oh, well, just don't hate it and it'll go away. But that doesn't work either. What you really have to see is that, you know, we're kind of, human beings love music, you know, and there's a way that, we're actually, turning to, it's quite subtle, but we're actually, playing it. It's like, I like it. I like that song. And so I may hate it, but I also like it. I may hate that it's there, but I also like it. Can you feel it? Yeah. So watch all of that. That is rich, you know. And what I've come to, like, this Bruno Mars thing was just recently, like a few weeks ago. And I was interested to watch it because what I realized what it's slowly progressing to for me in my own practice is, don't hate it and don't indulge it, you know, just and see what happens. Try to not go into either of those. And towards the end of the retreat, I realized that I couldn't remember what it was. And I struggled for a few seconds to try to recall the phrase that I kept repeating at the beginning of the retreat. I wanted to remember what it was. You see some of the madness of the mind, you know? It's fascinating stuff to watch. But can you just not have a view about it? You know? Know that you like it and know that you don't want it to be there and not, say anything more about it than that. Do you know what I mean? And let it run its course.
Yeah. I think maybe my question was, if I turn toward it and like let it become the object, is that indulging? And I think what I'm hearing is, look, it might be. That's the thing to be aware of. Oh, okay. Is there grasping here? Is this, using it to turn away from something else? And, you know, nobody but this mind can find out what's indulgence and what's pushing it.
That's right. And that's a good question because, I think you're only indulging it if you don't know you're doing it and you don't have any options. If enough of you is outside of it looking on it, even though it's still running, you're not indulging it. You know, at a very subtle level you are, but there's enough of you, looking at it with objectivity to garner some insight. Yeah? I like that. Yeah. That's really, refreshing. Okay. Don't worry. But, you know, cause if you feed back to the mind, you gotta stop indulging this. See where that takes you. You know, you know, all that stuff comes up, you know. You find a way to just relax in the presence of it and ride the pleasure of it a little bit. Let it be. And that could be, you know, that's a song, but it could be a vendetta. It could be any number of things, you know, it's the little events in our life that you keep rerunning. Do you have those? Yeah. You know, little exchanges. Ah, why did I say that? Or why did they say that? And it goes over and over. The mind is going over and over and over and over and over. And what it's doing and we can't see is it's got a view about it, you know, and it's buying into that view. That's a subtle attachment to a perception, a view, an idea. And it's trying desperately to get away from the pain of it. And yet that response or that approach doesn't do that. It doesn't take you away from it. It gets you deeper in. Your craving is grabbing and resisting. You know, the Buddha talks about this in the Second Noble Truth. It's the to-ing and fro-ing in the mind. Any kind of, indulging or resisting is craving. And that's what we've got to see. Yeah. Yes, please.
I find that, one thing that's really up for me is, habitual quality, behind a resentment.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't necessarily matter which one. You could pick a different one each day to chew on. It's immaterial, but I can see, and the arising is like a gotcha, you know, and then there's the seeing of it seeing the resistance and that starts to soften, but there is a remarkable amount of just habit energy momentum behind that.
Mm-hmm.
So even
that's great.
With sometimes clear seeing, sometimes that habit energy just has so much drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you might speak a little bit to the habitual, well-worn groove kind of mental states that...
Yeah, I'll talk about this a lot tonight, but also just to say, I mean, you're sitting there saying, you know, describing this, and I'm sitting here going, yeah, you got it. A plus. Yeah.
Now, would you please take it away?
This is what you want to see. And to see those well-worn grooves. This is your karma. these are your patterns, and this is what you want to see. You know, I'll never forget going to my teacher in my first 3-month retreat and said, you know, I'm just sitting here and I'm just lost in greed and hatred and delusion all the time. And he said, great. Yeah, you know, and I wanted to leave. You know, I said, it's not working. I'm not meditating. He said, if you're seeing that, now you can really start to meditate. Yeah.
Energy, yeah, is just a pattern. It's, you know, even letting go or letting drop some of the, you know, grabby quality of it. It's striking how much energy is there.
Yes, yeah, it's totally humbling. Bearing witness to one's karma, and what I mean by karma is the patterns and habits that. The constellations that each of us has. I mean, yours might be different than mine. There's avenues within those that are all the same. The five hindrances, the greed, hatred, and delusion, whatever. You can reduce it to forms that are common to all of us, but the particular content might differ, in each one of us. And so, and you might have strong patterns of one and me of, you know, hatred and me of greed or something like that, you know? So we do want to know that. But, it may not be good news in the short term, but to see the extent of this and how, powerful it is, how it seems to be living a life of its own, right? But, this is in the longer term, it actually is the content that it's over the years of practice, as you see yourself do this stuff over and over and over and over again. What I find anyway is that you stop making such a big deal out of it. And that's really the first layer that, you know, that has to transpire. It has to become the new normal in a way. You know, and, you get humbled by it. But if you can feel that, you reach a point where you just want to throw in the towel. I can't make this stop. Yeah. And if you reach that point, man, A++, because, something is dying and this tendency to take it all very personally or to think that it's me. It has to die, and it does die. It gradually weakens and then it gets uprooted. And we have this unbelievable, good fortune of having been born a human being who has the hardware and the software to look in this way. And that's what it takes to enlighten the mind, to awaken the mind. And so, you know, like I said last night, it'll make you a kind person. It'll make you patient. It's like, you know, when you start to see all the poo in your own mind, you know, when other people's poo is coming at you, you're much more kind, you know, accepting and, Not so harsh with each other as we're learning how not to be harsh with ourselves. This is how it happens. I think. I mean, you don't take my word for it. Yes, please.
After working more than 20 years in a human rights office, the last thing I wanted to do was complain or listen to a complaint.
Yes.
And I'm finding I don't have. And I'll give you an example. John spoke to me to find out if I had a concern, and we didn't get to talk. But anyway, I didn't have a concern about anything here. I don't want to complain.
Uh-huh.
So I told him I did not. I went to my room. I have a bed full of ants.
A what? A bed
ants.
Full?
I have a bed full of ants.
Ants?
Yes.
Oh, no. Oh, so I'm sorry. Oh, no, you can, let me wait for your question. Yeah, yeah. Huh?
Well, I have to run it still.
No. Go ahead. This is a good question, because, it can sound like what we're saying here is become a doormat. And that's not it. The Buddha is not saying lay down and take it. Shut up and take it, you know. It's what he's saying is it's much more subtler than that. You want to see the bit that goes on about it and pounces on it and, goes into these avenues that say it shouldn't be this way, that it denies the reality of it, right? And then it just, all he's saying to me is do that, always do that. And then if things, conditions need to be addressed, then you address them. I mean, if somebody in your life is, treating you badly, you have to address that. If you've got ants in your bed, you got to address that, you know? I mean, you could. I mean, I don't want to say, rule out the possibility. You could decide that as some kind of ascetic practice, I'm going to lay down with these ants, you know? That's okay. And I'm serious. People do that, you know? And you'll learn a lot, but no. Did you get a new room?
I just announced the ants because it's time to come.
Yeah, great. Now, just interestingly, the fluorescent lights, maybe you can see me, but now I can't see you. You're all kind of in shadow. So we might want to open these up too. Not now. We'll do it later. But these two on the sides, maybe. Hopefully it'll balance the light out. Cause you are just kind of, shadows. Yeah.
It seems like sometimes when I'm on the cushion, many times I feel like I'm going through a war zone.
Mm. You know, yeah.
Sometimes, you know, oh, okay, I'm making progress. Oh, here it comes again. So sometimes I leave my sittings feeling like I'm not getting anywhere. But what I have discovered is, over the years of doing this, is that I'm seeing the difference off the cushion when I'm interacting with people. So it's like something must be working. You know, I mean, I feel like that, you know, I'm running around in circles sometimes on the cushion, but something is penetrating because I'm responding to situations and people
yes.
so much differently.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Great. Yeah, that's how it unfolds. Everybody hear that? It's just seeing how things are changing. And despite the fact that many times as we practice on and off the cushion, we think we're not getting anywhere. Then you have an interaction with somebody that when all the conditions are there for you to really get annoyed with them or something, and you're not getting annoyed. You know, it's like, whoa, you know, that this is great stuff. So we enjoy the fruits of practice. And what it speaks to is that, and really, I hope we all really get this, that much more is happening in practice than we realize. And even if you're sort of vaguely knowing that the song is running and vaguely indulging it, you know, and it feels like, well, nothing's happening. The song is still there, you know, or the pattern is still there. That's not true. You know, the capacity to look, that little bit of you that is looking at it and not indulging it, is getting stronger. And it's actually affecting things already, even when it's only, a still small voice. You know, it's not the dominant feature of the mind, but it is getting stronger. So that's great. Thank you. Haven't you seen that? I mean, has anybody else seen that? Yeah. Yes, please.
Yeah, I've seen that. And maybe I get into an interaction with someone and I feel the annoyance, but then I'm able to understand. It was yesterday on the phone with someone, but they said something that, you know, yeah, that's what I said, like, you know, and I felt the annoyance come up, but rather than saying something likewise back to them, I was like, you know, able to say
yeah.
respond differently. That's the kind of thing that I notice.
Yeah. Really, those kinds of moments, it's very important that we take them to heart and really, really notice that, you know. My mind tends to be greedy, so I have to acknowledge that. But having said that, I kind of soak in that a little bit because it feels so good, you know, to let myself feel that. Somebody told me once recently that they told Ute Janiya that I said that. To soak in it. And he said, no, don't do that. And so, you know, far be it for me to challenge you, Tejaniya, but I think he didn't know what I was saying. You know, what I meant by that. It's just not, I'm not saying indulge it, but just to, it's there. The pleasant feeling is there. The pleasant feeling of release. You know, we want to use pleasure and pain in practice. There's a painful feeling of attachment associated with attachment. There's a pleasant feeling that's associated with non-attachment. And, we do need to take that in. Thank you. Yeah.
To build on what Lisa just said, I've also found that in the past, if I was meeting with someone else who, let's say, kind of was churned up, I would think, boy, they need meditation.
Yeah.
Like, I'll be hearing these teachings, I'll immediately think of the person who would benefit from meditation. So I stay that way. But I realize that it changes that I'll recognize that their mind is agitated.
Yes.
Present right here, hearing what we're all saying, that we are now here in fear, afraid, and all into the future. And not yourself. It's helping me sort of see what other people's mental states are.
Yeah. That's right. And the Buddha says that, to know them internally and externally. The different, one little caveat I'll put on that one, though, is when it comes to the mind, we don't know. We want to be sure to acknowledge that we do not know what is in their mind. We can see the effect of it. And we may be right. We can sort of vaguely know they're caught in something, you know, but we just want to make sure that we don't go too far with it. But we can know when they're barking at us, you know, that, they're agitated and there's some, unpleasant feeling perhaps that they aren't aware of, or, that they're stuck in a delusion that thinks that this is going to help, you know. But just to know that we don't know exactly what's in their mind. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. And there's a whole other thing with that, but I think it's, I'm not going to go there. Yeah. Yes, please. And then I'll come to you. Yeah.
I'm thinking of the times when you go back to the breath, and a lot of times what we, you know, what the questions have been about times when you're getting kind of into stuff. When is it wise to just say, I really need to go back to the breath? And are there ways of working with the breath that are like more detailed so that it becomes a little more easy to stay there for a bit?
Mm-hmm.
Because the, you know, breath, it's this, you know, it's boring. It's really boring. Yeah,
it can be.
It's real boring, especially mm-hmm. after all the drama.
Mm.
And are there ways of working with the breath that help you go more like into the details of the breath so that it seems like it's a place to stay?
Can be. I mean, did everybody hear that? Are there ways of working with the breath to, you know, go back to the breath or to work with the breath that make it more interesting so you can stay with it, right? That's part of it.
And is that wise or is that a retreat?
It's tricky. It's tricky. It can be. You really have to look because the mind can, you know, that instruction to go back to the breath. I don't see anywhere in the Satipatthana Sutta where the Buddha says that, you know. It's interesting, but it is kind of a common way that it's taught. And I think you just have to weigh. You have to look and see. It, to the extent that we're completely lost in something and not able to get footing outside of it, then what the Buddha says in this, he gives some different ways to deal with that, what the distracted thought, you know, just that tendency of the mind to be going on about things. There's five of them, and one of them is not go back to the breath. You know, none of them are go back to the breath. They're just to try to bring in something that is the opposite of it. The second one has to do with pause a moment and remember, oh man, I know what this is like. I've done this before, and I know if I keep buying into it, I'm going to keep suffering. Just to go back to the past times that we've done it and see if that helps. And if that doesn't help, then you bring in like distract the mind with something else. So it could be the breath, but it's not necessarily saying that. And if that doesn't work, then slow it down. Try to slow it down enough to get some footing in relation to it. And then if that doesn't work, then get the heck out of Dodge. You know, it's like he says, beat it down. Beat it down. Sometimes you have to say, no, I'm not going to do this. So there's a lot of different responses to it, how to deal with repeated thought, you know. And yes, it can be skillful to turn the direction to something else, to the breath. The difficulty is that in this moment, when you're caught, you're suffering. And it's quite possible that you can turn towards it instead of away from it. And it's quite possible that the turning back to the breath is a diversion to get away from it. And you just want to be clear that that's not what you're doing. Do you know what I mean? And so you have to look and say, it's tricky. I'm not saying there's hard and fast responses to this. But it's like, just pause a moment, I find, and say, you know, can I turn towards this? If not, then do one of the other things. You know, but if you can, just recognize that there's something in here that I'm clinging to because it's unpleasant. And I'm not catching that. You know what I mean?
Well, it sounds very subtle.
It is very subtle.
It's very subtle.
Yeah.
So the breath could be a kind of cushy chair you go to.
Yeah.
And maybe that's not good.
Maybe that's not good. It can be a very sophisticated way of deflecting the attention from dukkha. And we want to see dukkha. Dukkha is difficulty, suffering. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just look and see. It may not be. But it's not as hard and fast or simple as it might appear. Yeah. Oh, wait. I was going to go to him first, and then we'll come to you. Yeah. Paul. Paul.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we know it's well established the madness of our own minds. And then we notice our friends, well, they could really use no meditation. And then we notice the headlines of the world and the heaviness of the world and the dukkha in the world, and sometimes it can seem a little overwhelming.
Yeah.
So what are skillful practices? Like, I don't want to, you know, turn away from that, because I think we should be really well aware of what's happening in our world. But on the other hand, you don't want to have a stick to you. I don't know how to approach that.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's tricky. And apropos to what I was saying about that, it's what the unawakened mind is struggling with is the conditions of this human birth. That everything's uncertain. There's a high degree of difficulty and pain in it. And we don't have a lot of control over any of it. And everything in the mind is And the unawakened mind is fighting that, not wanting it not to be that way. So I think what the Buddha is pointing to is turn towards it, let it be that way. So, you know, the things that you describe, you have a good cry about it. You know, you allow you name and feel the pain of craving and ignorance and delusion, you know, just the delusion in the world that, people are turning to these, ridiculous, tired, old, worn out strategies that never worked, never have worked, and never will. Repeatedly, for eons. Yeah? You know, Ajahn Chah said, if you haven't felt the depth of anxiety that you feel when you touch that, you haven't begun to practice. That's can be some of the stuff that gives Buddhism a bad name, but, you know, it is nonetheless our practice. So, then you, maybe you could say, shouldn't I do something about it? You can. But in a way, the Buddha is silent on that. It's up to you. Each of us has our calling. Each of us has our forte, what we're good at. And you may decide that you want to align those two somehow. You know, what are you good at, and apply it to some form of suffering or another. But that, the difference is that when you do that out of wisdom, when you do that having seen the harm and embraced the harm, then you, what you do is very different, and how you do it is very different than if you're still fighting it. Isn't it? Yeah. I know you know. And then, so those moments that are yucky, you ride the wave of them. And no, you know, it's like it goes deeper into the heart. It's like this. And over lifetimes, I think that understanding becomes the bit that really feeds and fuels the urgency to awaken. Because the only way out of it is not to get reborn. So, which is a tall order. Yeah.
I guess what prompted this question was your response to her about watching the breath or being with the breath or experiencing the breath. I noticed that you don't do that. You don't say that. You point to relaxation. You point to letting go, but you don't use the breath. Is that something you strategically don't do? And I also noticed you don't do the body scan that some people do. Is that a...
I'm not a good meditation teacher. I'm not a technician. And, I do, you know, I think this morning I talked about seeing the breath and being with the breath, allowing it. Didn't I? I think I did. But I'm not trying not to do that. Let me put it this way. So, yeah. But,
the Buddha really didn't point to the breath.
Well, look at this. This sutta is, 11 pages long. Okay? The bit about the breath is less than half of a page. I find it helpful. But I have, myself in my own practice, and certainly working with other people in their practice, have been tripped up by an instruction that says, make the breath your primary object, and when you're all over the place, go back to the breath. That has its usefulness in a very specific range of experience. It doesn't have much usefulness beyond that because of self-view. Because the sense of self picks that up and says, oh, I get it. All I have to do is keep coming back to the breath, and I'll be a good meditator. And you can do that. I mean, I did it. And I probably did that for 8 or 10 years, thinking I was developing some skill in meditation, which if I had been developing some samadhi by doing that, okay, that's good. That would be good. But I wouldn't say that I had. I was particularly developing that. If I was actually garnering some wisdom around that, then I would say, yeah, if while you're doing that, you're actually noticing what it was that took you away and what it felt like to have been taken away, then yeah. So that I have to qualify it. Do you know what I'm saying?
I'm curious about if there's another way to really calm that mind, you know, without having some sort of a...
Yes, and that goes back to part of your question about a formal retreat, you know, like when, you know, should I just do that? Part of your question was something about should I just train in that way, coming back to the breath, I think.
No, I just wanted to know if there was a time when that was the one thing
that's
to
it.
Do.
That's right. And I would say, yeah. I mean, I don't want to... push these things away just because I don't necessarily use them. But I think that they're if you're going to go on a long retreat and you really are going to take a couple of weeks to calm the mind by paying attention to the breathing, then that's good. And most of us aren't doing that though. You know, I guess some of this is proceeding really, Tammy, from teaching lay people who are practicing in 24/7 kind of lay practice. Going back to the breath can be like counting to three. And so in that sense, it can be useful and it can break the spell. We're mesmerized, you know. But if you only do that and you're not seeing the rest of it, then what you're cultivating is possibly samadhi, but maybe not even that, you know? And what you're not cultivating is insight. So I just take, that's all. I mean, maybe I'm going on too long about it, but some of it's how my teachers taught me too. Yeah. Yeah. So I hope that, am I thoroughly confusing you? Yeah. Or is this helpful? Okay. Yeah.
So what I found is for years and years, I've been struggling with, I can't calm my mind. I can't, focus on the breath. My mind's all over the place. And just recently, I've had a little bit of a turn, and your instructions this morning were very helpful in validating that, of relaxing, because I find that when I focus on the breath or try to do a concentration, I can feel my body getting so tense, and I realize, well, this is this is suffering.
Totally.
It feels like suffering. And so I took your instructions as rest in the breath.
Let the body breathe.
Let the body breathe. Relax, rest. And so there was this dichotomy between focusing on the breath and my mind running all over the place. And now I have a kind of intentional relaxation. That the effort is not effort, it's intention to rest.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, but I hope everybody heard that. That's great, because what you're really picking up very well on what I'm trying to point to here, you know, that just look at the difference and maybe play with this a little on this retreat. Look at the difference between being a meditator who's doing the meditation. Okay, me, I'm in here. I am the meditator, and I am directing the course of my meditation. Yeah? feel what that feels like when you're doing it, because you probably are doing it. We all do it. And just to feel that. And then compare that. Give the mind the information it needs to compare this to what you're describing. Just, okay, now relax. You know, don't do the meditation. Just relax. Let the body breathe. And notice that there is a knowing of that happening. It's not me knowing it. There is a knowing there, and you settle into that in the same way as you do the relaxing. It's subtle stuff, admittedly, right? But you felt it.
But the other side of it is an awareness that all that thinking is, for me anyway, an attempt to control.
Yeah.
An attempt to get away from part of what's scary about the breath is a sense of groundlessness.
Yeah.
And so what I've been trying to do is when I feel that anxiety come up, just, okay, there it is. that's how it feels to feel, to let go of all that stuff.
Totally. As I was saying, as relentless as that habit is to take control and start to be the CEO and manage it all, as relentless as that is, be as relentless in relaxing and settling into knowing. And, you know, until this new way dominates, until it gets stronger, you know, strong enough to take over. I'm jokingly saying, you know, I'm not a good meditation teacher, but I think I'm trying to get at is, meditation that is driven by self-view versus meditation. You know, when you hear a meditation instruction and it says do this, and then you have this really strong feeling inside that says, oh, I've got it. You know, I know how to meditate. Let me just do it. Very easily, that's just the sense of self that's trying to fix and control and manage. And this is not an indictment. I have found in my own practice, it can't be any other way. You know, the self-view is that strong that you have to know that it's going to be activated in this enterprise of meditation. And we're trying to see that and in a way offset it. I was going to say take it on, but no. It's just offset it. Just find another way. Yeah? Are you with me? Y'all know what I'm saying. Yeah. I mean, it's tricky. I mean, I'm wanting to use the meditation as a way to garner insight into non-self or to see how the self is trying to take over the meditation. And it's not, and notice the, it's okay. Just notice the consequences of having a meditator on your back, you know, and notice what it's like when it's not like that. Yeah. There's somebody over here.
Illness and surgery and intense pain. I've seen the instruction to sit as a kind of metaphor for stillness. And I wonder if you could comment on that. If you're lying in a hospital, it seems to me that has been my equivalent of sitting. But perhaps that's a deception.
No, that's fine. I think you're trying to be with what is and not have a quarrel with it. That's the metaphor for stillness I think you're describing, right? Let it, to me, be with the body and leave it at that. Be with feeling and leave it at that. Be with the mind and leave it at that. Be with the mind, what the mind is doing and leave it at that. Yeah. And there was one more over here. Yeah, yeah. That's, I knew I saw a hand. Yeah.
I'm just really enjoying the basic instruction of relax.
Mm-hmm.
The awareness of years ago, when some journaling is just relax, stay open, came up for me, and it just come back over and over and over with what you're saying. And I find that that it comes up over and over in my living in the world, and that. That's really what it's about, is just relaxing and knowing what's happening, not about being a certain way.
Right.
And then this discussion about the breath, and I want to jump in on that, because what I find, not so much on the cushion, because I'm not a good medicator, but I take this practice in the world regularly. So I found myself in situations like standing in my boss's office and having some conversation about something that's difficult, something that's happened, and the tension arising in me, and seeing there's a touchstone to the breath, or to the body, feeling the feet on the carpet, or feeling touching on the breath, just as a touchstone to be here, and then experiencing what's happening. So that I recognize the activity that's coming up.
Yes.
And have a chance to respond.
Yeah.
Maybe after some activities are come up and say, you know, I noticed that this conversation is bringing this up, you know, trying to find ways to say that in the workforce, you know, the work world that's not too personal, but also acknowledges, hey, I'm reacting to this, and you probably see I'm reacting to this.
Yeah.
And this is what's going on for me, so now let's have a conversation about what we need to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, and so... that I love it that we talk about coming back to the breath, but it's only as a touch there to be here that allows me to open the space to see what else is happening.
That's great. That's a better answer, Tammy. Use it. I mean, it's not to ignore it or deny it, but use it as that. Well, touchstone's a good word, or just a remembering kind of thing. You know, sati, mindfulness, the word that's often translated as mindfulness is, really means remembering. You know, the better translation for it is remembering. So you go, oh, okay, wait a minute. You know, right in that moment where I'm about to really get pissed off at my boss, I can remember that I can, you know, because of remembering the breath, because of what that does when I do that, I stabilize the internal world a little bit. It's going a little crazy around difficulty and uncertainty and the fact that I don't have control. And what I can do is, quiet it a little bit in the presence of that. That's all.
Stay open, breathe.
So I connect to the breath, I connect to relax, and stay open. Yeah.
I connect to relax, you know, it's like the three,
there's this little thing for me that happened that helped bring it back. Yeah, that's great. Everybody here, you should come sit here. Okay. So we've gone a little bit over.